2,000-year-old poem may still, conceivably, speak to us with as much force as it did to the people of its day. We would not expect the same from a 2,000-year-old newspaper editorial or a 2,000-year-old advertising jingle, nor should we expect it from Cicero. Cicero, born in the century before Christ, exercised his techniques when Republican Rome, in all its vigour, welcomed public men. Augustine loved Cicero, as did the whole Latin world, which placed the Roman orator just below Virgil on the divinity charts. Jerome, the cantankerous translator of the Latin Bible, awoke one night in a frenzied sweat. He had dreamed that Christ had condemned him to hell for being more a Ciceronian than a Christian. The ancients held the practical use of words in much higher regard than we do, probably because they were much closer to the oral customs of prehistoric village life. So clearly reflected in Nestor's speech to the Greek chieftains in the Iliad, and in Mark Antony's speech over Julius Caesar's body, in which the fate of an entire race may hang on one man's words. But we are made uncomfortable and bored by Cicero's elaborately coaching us in all the tricks of his trade, the many techniques for convincing others to act the way we want them to. For Cicero, to speak from the heart would be the rashest foolishness. One must always speak from calculation. What do I want to see happen here? What are the desires of my audience? How can I motivate them to do my will? How shall I disguise my weakest arguments? How dazzle my listeners so they are no longer able to reason matters through independently? The techniques of the successful politician, the methods of modern advertising, the whole panoply of persuasion is to be found in Cicero. The figure closest to him in our own age might be Dale Carnegie, who advised that every single word and gesture be calculated to win and influence. However squeamish such advice may make us, to the ancients it made perfect sense. For in addition to learning how to write a poem for one's own satisfaction, in addition to learning how to turn a phrase in a letter so as to please a friend, there was a larger literary task to be played out in the larger world, the polis, to which all educated men were bound to make their contribution, to bring their positive influence to bear. And this world of politics required the arts of persuasion, if one were to meet with success. In Ausonius, classical education calcified into the merely ornamental. In Augustine, it remains as vigorous as it had been in Cicero's day. And Augustine will spend his life using Cicero's elaborate and nuanced arsenal of techniques on behalf of a new worldview and a new political agenda. This will be the public contribution of Augustine, the Roman citizen, to the dying Roman res publica. Besides the arts of rhetoric and persuasion, there was a third pursuit for the liberally educated man, a pursuit only a gifted seeker could successfully embark on, the way of philosophy. Beyond the literary arts lies, however dimly perceived, the ascent to truth, to wisdom. In Augustine's day, this ascent was illumined by the works of one great teacher, Plato, the Greek philosopher who had been Socrates' pupil and who was born in the time and place that all educated men looked to as the Golden Age. Athens in the 5th century BC. If the liberal arts were for the few, philosophy was for the fewer. Many liberally educated men did not even assent to the goal of philosophy because they did not think it possible to attain to truth or wisdom with any certitude. Cicero was such an agnostic. After a long pursuit of philosophical truth, he found himself siding with the skeptics, who believed in the uncertainty of all ultimate knowledge, though he inclined in moral matters to the school of the Stoics, who believed with certitude that virtue will yield happiness. Cicero's even-tempered agnosticism will come as no surprise to anyone in our world who has noticed what a convenient philosophy it makes for Cicero's contemporary children. Publicists, marketeers, and all those who seek to motivate us to do what we might otherwise not think to do. As a philosopher, Cicero was the great packager of his age, an unoriginal thinker with real flair, a sort of Will Durant, who could dramatize all the currents and schools of thought so that anyone might understand them well enough to talk about them at a cocktail party. But Augustine wanted truth, not cheap success. Such a pressure cooker psyche can settle for nothing less. He soon abandoned the simple emotional Catholicism of his mother and adopted something more exclusive and recherché. The religion of Mani, a Persian syncretist, who had taken this and that from here and there and come up with something that can only strike us as a California cult. A little Christian symbolism, a large dose of Zoroastrian dualism, and some of the quiet refinements of Buddhism. It was called Manichaeism. For a while, it let Augustine off the hook. For one thing, it absolved him from any responsibility for his raging lusts. In Mani's system, good was passive, unable to battle the gross and fleshly evils that raged against it. It was a made-to-order religion for a smart young provincial who needed to explore every dark corner of the boiling city and experience every dark pleasure it had to offer, and, at the same time, think himself above the herd. But it couldn't keep up with Augustine's fearlessly inquiring mind. Like Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormonism, it was full of assertions, but could yield no intellectual system to nourish a great intellect. We don't know what Augustine read, but we know he devoured books. By his own admission, he never learned Greek properly. Plato, however, was readily available in translation and packaged by commentators of far greater profundity than Cicero. Plato was in the air Augustine breathed, the figure a thoughtful young man must sooner or later test himself against. Augustine, disappointed with Manichaeism, and now appointed to his first big job as professor of rhetoric at Milan, forms a new and, of course, exclusive group. A temporary monastic community of like-minded young men who mean to ascend to truth with the aid of Plato and his Latin commentators. Their earnest intentions will eventually be thwarted when their wives-to-be object to all this moping about. And soon enough, Augustine's mother will arrive on the scene, creating, as she always does, emotional tornadoes and hurricanes, a sort of one-woman African Sturm und Drang. But the establishment, even for a short time, of such a community gives us an idea of how seriously and personally the pursuit of philosophy could be taken in the ancient world. Something far closer to an ashram than to a modern department of philosophy. And this community will provide Augustine with the seedbed he needs for his own philosophy to germinate. Socrates, at least in Plato's accounts of him, did not so much build a positive philosophy as pose questions. Questions that show up the utter foolishness of his interlocutor's assumptions. He, of course, invented the Socratic method, forcing his students to start their quest for truth with a confession of their own ignorance. Plato, the product of this method, reasons with delicate skill toward the creation of a large and airy edifice, the grandest construct of ancient philosophy. Plato begins with his own experience of a spark of divinity in all the creatures of the natural world, a spark he experiences particularly in himself and other human beings, in other words, the daimon of Socrates. But the spark is experienced within a world of corruption and death, the world of the flesh. It is worth our while to take a few moments to receive Plato in his own words, for they give us an idea both of the challenge confronting Augustine and of the flavor of the Augustinian ashram. Most of Plato is impenetrable on first reading. If it begins to give you a headache, skip to the end of the passage and just take my word for it. Here is Plato in the Phaedrus, on the spark, the daimon, the soul. Of the nature of the soul, psuche in Greek, though her true form be ever a theme of large and more than mortal discourse, let me speak briefly and in a figure. And let the figure be composite, a pair of winged horses and a charioteer. Now, the winged horses and the charioteers of the gods are all of them noble and of noble descent. But those of other races are mixed. The human charioteer drives his in a pair, and one of them is noble and of noble breed, and the other is ignoble and of ignoble breed. And the driving of them of necessity gives a great deal of trouble to him. I will endeavour to explain to you in what way the mortal differs from the immortal creature. The soul, in her totality, has the care of inanimate being everywhere, and traverses the whole heaven in divers forms appearing. When perfect and fully winged, she soars upward and orders the whole world, whereas the imperfect soul, losing her wings and drooping in her flight, at last settles on the solid ground. There, finding a home, she receives an earthly frame which appears to be self-moved, but is really moved by her power, and this composition of soul and body is called a living and mortal creature. For immortal, no such union can be reasonably believed to be, although fancy, not having seen nor surely known the nature of God, may imagine an immortal creature having both a body and also a soul which are united throughout all time. Let that, however, be as God wills, and be spoken of acceptably to him. And now, let us ask the reason why the soul loses her wings. The wing is the corporeal element which is most akin to the divine, and which by nature tends to soar aloft and carry that which gravitates downwards into the upper region, which is the habitation of the gods. The divine is beauty, wisdom, goodness, and the like, and by these the wing of the soul is nourished and grows apace. But when fed upon evil and foulness, and the opposite of good, wastes and falls away. Zeus, the mighty lord, holding the reins of a winged chariot, leads the way to heaven, ordering all and taking care of all. And there follows him the array of gods and demigods, marshalled in 11 bands. Hestia alone abides at home in the house of heaven. Of the rest, they who are reckoned among the princely 12 march in their appointed order. They see many blessed sights in the inner heaven, and there are many ways to and fro, along which the blessed gods are passing, everyone doing his own work. He may follow who will and can, for jealousy has no place in the celestial choir. But when they go to banquet and festival, then they move up the steep to the top of the vault of heaven. The chariots of the gods in even poise, obeying the rein, glide happily. But the others labor, for the vicious steed goes heavily, weighing down the charioteer to the earth when his steed has not been thoroughly trained. And this is the hour of agony and extremest conflict for the soul. For the immortals, when they are at the end of their course, go forth and stand upon the outside of heaven, and the revolution of the spheres carries them round, and they behold the things beyond. But of the heaven which is above the heavens, what earthly poet ever did or ever will sing worthily? It is such as I will describe, for I must dare to speak the truth, when truth is my theme. There abides the very being with which true knowledge is concerned, the colourless, formless, intangible essence visible only to mind, the pilot of the soul. The divine intelligence being nurtured upon mind and pure knowledge, and the intelligence of every soul which is capable of receiving the food proper to it, rejoices at beholding reality, and once more gazing upon truth, is replenished and made glad, until the revolution of the worlds brings her round again to the same place. In the revolution she beholds justice and temperance and knowledge absolute, not in the form of generation or of relation which men call existence, but knowledge absolute in existence absolute. And beholding the other true existences in like manner, and feasting upon them, she passes down into the interior of the heavens, and returns home. And there the charioteer, putting up his horses at the stall, gives them ambrosia to eat, a nectar to drink. Such is the life of the gods. But of other souls, that which follows God best and is likest to him lifts the head of the charioteer into the outer world and is carried round in the revolution, troubled indeed by the steeds and with difficulty beholding true being, while another only rises and falls and sees and again fails to see by reason of the unruliness of the steeds. The rest of the souls are also longing after the upper world, and they all follow. But not being strong enough, they are carried round below the surface, plunging, treading on one another, each striving to be first. And there is confusion and perspiration and the extremity of effort, and many of them are lamed or have their wings broken through the ill driving of the charioteers. And all of them, after a fruitless toil, not having attained to the mysteries of true being, go away and feed upon opinion. The reason why the souls exhibit this exceeding eagerness to behold the plain of truth is that pasturage is found there, which is suited to the highest part of the soul, and the wing on which the soul soars is nourished with this. And there is a law of destiny that the soul which attains any vision of truth in company with a god is preserved from harm until the next period, and if attaining always, is always unharmed. But when she is unable to follow and fails to behold the truth, and through some ill hap sinks beneath the double load of forgetfulness and vice, and her wings fall from her and she drops to the ground, then the law ordains that this soul shall at her first birth pass not into any other animal, but only into man. And the soul which has seen most of truth shall come to the birth as a philosopher or artist or some musical and loving nature. That which has seen truth in the second degree shall be some righteous king or warrior chief. The soul which is of the third class shall be a politician, or economist, or trader. The fourth shall be a lover of gymnastic toils, or a physician. The fifth shall lead the life of a prophet, or hierophant. To the sixth, the character of a poet, or some other imitative artist will be assigned. To the seventh, the life of an artisan or husbandman. To the eighth, that of a sophist or demagogue. To the ninth, that of a tyrant. And all these are states of probation, in which he who does righteously improves, and he who does unrighteously deteriorates his lot. Plato is the greatest of all Greek prose stylists, and through his tightly woven sentences run threads of delicate beauty and elusive grace. He doesn't sound like anyone else, and he convinces us not only of the largeness of his mind, but of the genuine mysticism of his spirit. He tells us from the start that he is using metaphor, but we cannot help believe that he has glimpsed the world beyond the veil. He has at least as much in common with the wisdom of the East, with Buddhism and Taoism, as he does with the subsequent philosophy of the West. He is simply the great philosopher, and the difficulty one experiences in understanding him is not a difficulty based on superficial obfuscation, but on his genuine profundity. No one grasps Plato by reading him through quickly or once. So it was for Augustine, and thus the necessity of the ashram, and stillness, and philosophical companionship. Augustine's spirit resonates with the plangent chords of Plato. The restless, exiled soul, looking everywhere for its true home, feasting on sewage while dimly remembering the nectar and ambrosia of high heaven. Plato is right, and his are the most profound descriptions in all the ancient world of the miraculous golden flashes of yearning embedded in the dross of reality, the out-of-jointness of the universe. Who else, Augustine asks himself, even talks of these things? And then the answer comes to him. Saul of Tarsus, the wiry, bald-headed Jew whose awkward, importunate letters signed Paul, the Christians have been using as scripture. For the flesh lusteth against the spirit, and the spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary, the one to the other, so that ye cannot do the things that ye would. Surely this is meaningless coincidence. What could a sweaty little nobody, dashing about the Mediterranean basin, have in common with the loftiest philosopher of all? And yet, Augustine begins to read Paul seriously. He entertains the possibility that Plato even has something wrong, that the ascent to truth is not a task the philosopher takes upon himself and succeeds at by his own effort. Has the great Plato mistakenly equated knowledge with virtue? For if the flesh and the spirit are at war, isn't the human enterprise doomed to failure, even when joined by the most exalted philosophical types? Mustn't Paul be closer to the mark when he says of pre-born souls, the same souls Plato is describing in his metaphor of the charioteers, for whom God did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called, and whom he called, them he also justified, and whom he justified, them he also glorified. In other words, if we mud-spattered human beings are ever to ascend to truth, we can do it only because God, a force ineffably greater than our war-torn selves, has predestined us and calls us upward. We will never make it under our own steam. Having made this connection, Augustine falls apart. What he describes at this point in The Confessions is a full-scale emotional breakdown. And all over an idea? Yes, for Augustine, ideas do not float free, abstracted from their human context. He personalizes everything, even the most rarefied philosophical utterances. without education, he would probably have been a self-destructive provincial roustabout, always smouldering with one fire or another. With the discipline of his education, he is transformed into that unusual specimen, neither denatured academic nor effete upper-class connoisseur, but a man of feeling who takes ideas seriously. As with Tolstoy and Joyce, both educated wild men, the riotous blood of his homeland beats forever in his veins and animates his every thought. While talking with his fellow seeker, Alypius, he begins to weep uncontrollably. This mighty shower of tears, as he calls it, comes upon him out of nowhere. From the secret bottom of my soul. Abashed, he runs from the house into the garden, throwing himself under a fig tree, and giving full vent to my tears. He begins to wail near nonsense, for no reason he can understand. And thou, O Lord, how long? How long, O Lord, will you stay angry for ever? From a house bordering the garden, he hears a child's voice, chanting nonsense of its own. Tole, lege, tole, lege. Take, read, take, read. Never having heard this children's song before, he decides it is a sign meant for him. He returns to the house and takes from the table, where the stunned Alypius is still sitting, the book he had been reading earlier, an edition of Paul's letters. In the time-honored fashion of the ancient world, he opens the book at random, intending to receive as a divine message the first sentence his eyes should fall upon. The sentence he reads is, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. Augustine is caught. He submits himself to the death of the flesh through baptism, and to the Christian God. We have been using Augustine as a lens for viewing the classical world. What is about to be lost in the century of the barbarian invasions is literature, the content of classical civilization. Had the destruction been complete, had every library been disassembled and every book burned, we might have lost Homer and Virgil and all of classical poetry, Herodotus and Tacitus and all of classical history, Demosthenes and Cicero and all of classical oratory, Plato and Aristotle and all of Greek philosophy, and Plotinus and Porphyry and all the subsequent commentary. We would have lost the taste and smell of a whole civilization. 12 centuries of lyric beauty, aching tragedy, intellectual enquiry, scholarship, sophistry, and love of wisdom. The acme of ancient civilized discourse would all have gone down the drain of history. All but a few lines of Sappho, and much of the work of the Greek tragedians, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, did go down that drain. And we very nearly lost the whole of Latin literature. We did lose, at any rate, the spirit of classical civilization. At certain epochs, wrote Kenneth Clark, in civilization. Man has felt conscious of something about himself, body and spirit, which was outside the day-to-day struggle for existence and the night-to-night struggle with fear. And he has felt the need to develop these qualities of thought and feeling so that they might approach, as nearly as possible, to an ideal of perfection, reason, justice, physical beauty, all of them in equilibrium. He has managed to satisfy this need in various ways, through myths, through dance and song, through systems of philosophy, and through the order that he has imposed upon the visible world. The struggle for existence and the struggle with fear now gain the ascendancy once more, and what remains of classical civilization will be henceforth found not in life, but between the covers of books. What is really lost when a civilization wearies and grows small is confidence. A confidence built on the order and balance that leisure makes possible. Again, Clark. Civilization requires a modicum of material prosperity, enough to provide a little leisure, but far more it requires confidence. Confidence in the society in which one lives. Belief in its philosophy, belief in its laws, and confidence in one's own mental powers. Vigor, energy, vitality. All the great civilizations, or civilizing epochs, have had a weight of energy behind them. People sometimes think that civilization consists in fine sensibilities and good conversation and all that. These can be among the agreeable results of civilization, but they are not what make a civilization. And a society can have these amenities and yet be dead and rigid. Whether insoluble political realities or inner spiritual sickness is more to blame for the fall of classical civilization is finally beside the point. The life behind the works we have been studying, the passionate nobility of Virgil, the cool rationality of Cicero, the celestial meditativeness of Plato, this flame of civilization is about to be extinguished. The works themselves will, miraculously, escape destruction. But they will enter the new world of the Middle Ages as things so strange they might as well have been left behind by interstellar aliens. One example will suffice to illustrate the strangeness of books to medieval men. The word grammar, the first step in the course of classical study that moulded all educated men from Plato to Augustine, will be mispronounced by one barbarian tribe as glamour. In other words, whoever has grammar, whoever can read, possesses magic inexplicable. So the living civilization died, to be reassembled and assessed by scholars of later ages from the texts preserved miraculously in the pages of its books. There is, however, one classical tradition that survived the transition, the still living tradition of Roman law. We have encountered Roman law already as a dead letter, promulgated by the emperor and circumvented first by the powerful, then, increasingly, by anyone who could get away with it. As the emperor's laws become weaker, the ceremony surrounding them becomes more baroque, In the last days, the Divine One's edict is written in gold on purple paper, received with covered hands in the fashion of a priest handling sacred vessels, held aloft for adoration by the assembled throng, who prostrate themselves before the law, and then ignore it. But this picture alone would be misleading, just as we found earlier that the ancients had far greater respect than we for practical public discourse, so they had far greater fear of chaos. The Britons, the Gauls, the Africans, the Slavs, who long ago had flocked to the Roman standard, forsaking their petty tribal loyalties and becoming Roman citizens, gained greatly. By exchanging tribal identity for the penumbra of citizenship, they won the protection of the Pax Romana and its predictability. With the decline of sudden and unexpected violence of all kinds, they could look forward in a way they had never been able to do before. They could plan, they could prosper, they could expect to live a normal lifespan. As Roman culture died out and was replaced by vibrant new barbarian growths, people forgot many things. How to read, how to think, how to build magnificently. But they remembered and they mourned the lost peace. Call them the people of the Dark Ages, if you will, but do not underestimate the desire of these early medieval men and women for the rule of law. There was, moreover, one office that survived intact from the classical to the medieval polis, the office of Catholic bishop. In late antiquity, as municipal and provincial governments disintegrated and imperial appointees abandoned their posts, there was one official who could be counted on to stay with his people, even to death. The episcopos. Say it quickly, and you will hear where the English word bishop comes from. A Greek word meaning overseer or superintendent. In the Acts of the Apostles and the letters of Paul, bishops are mentioned occasionally as church functionaries, hardly distinguishable from priests. From the Greek presbyteroi, or elders. Most early Christian congregations seem to have been run by some combination of bishops and priests, local men, and in the first stages of development, women as well, who were chosen by the congregants for specified terms to take care of practical matters. With the deaths of the apostles, apostoloi, or envoys, who had been the chief conveyors of Jesus' message, the role of the bishop grew, and by the beginning of the second century we find him being treated in a more exalted manner, as a successor to the dead apostles and symbol of unity for the local congregation, but still the appointee of his congregation. As its symbol of unity, he was duty-bound to consult his congregation in all important matters. From the beginning of my episcopacy, the aristocratic Cyprian of Carthage, monumental bishop of 3rd century Africa, confided to his clergy, I made up my mind to do nothing on my own private opinion, without your advice and without the consent of the people. By the end of Augustine's life, such consultation was becoming the exception. Democracy depends on a well-informed electorate. And bishops could no longer rely on the opinion of their flocks, increasingly uninformed and harried illiterates. nor, in all likelihood, were they averse to seeing their own power grow at the expense of the people. In many districts they were already the sole authority left, the last vestige of Roman law and order. They began to appoint one another, and thus was born, 5 centuries after the death of Jesus, the self-perpetuating hierarchy that rules the Catholic Church to this day. The Roman polis had always depended more upon living men than written laws. Laws had to be interpreted and executed, and men of property and standing were allowed much leeway in interpreting the laws. Now, bishops, along with the petty kings and princes of the New World Order, would become the only men of property and standing left. The king, or local chief, was likely to be a barbarian with peculiar notions of justice, and few, whatever, of order. It would become the task of the bishop, often the only man who still had books of any kind, and, save for his scribes, the only man who could read and write, to civilize the ruler, to introduce to him diplomatically some elementary principles of justice and good government. Thus did the power of the bishop, sometimes himself the only prince in sight, continue to wax. Augustine died as the Vandals besieged the gates of the city he served as bishop, so he didn't live quite long enough to experience the disorderly tempests of this new world order at their most ripping. Still, his last years were crammed with stress and controversy. Following his conversion, he had hoped to continue in the quiet pursuit of truth, in a philosophical community of like-minded friends. But the stiffness of his backbone, which in a more peaceful age would have retarded his ecclesiastical progress, gave him the appearance of a ready-made bishop, a shepherd of courage, who would not desert his vulnerable flock. And it was only a matter of time before some church drafted him. In the event, it was Hippo, second city of Roman Africa. If the ancient Eastern or Greek church has many fathers, theologians who articulated the classical formulations of faith to the Greco-Roman world, the ancient Western or Latin church has only one worth speaking of, Augustine. Out of his interior dialogues with Plato and Paul, he formulated the doctrine of original sin. The sin of Adam and Eve passed from generation to generation in the fleshly act of generativity. As in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. Augustine interprets these words of Paul as description of the necessary solidarity of the human race, both in falling hopelessly into sin and rising by grace to redemption. He formulates the doctrine of grace, the gift of God freely given to men who cannot merit it. He even formulates an explanation of the Trinity. God is one, as in the Old Testament, the scripture of the Jews, but at the very heart of reality is relation, the relatedness of friends. For God, the one is three, the Father who loves the Son begotten of the Father's love from all eternity, and the Holy Spirit, the love of Father and Son so strong that it forms a third person in this divine Trinity. In 410, Rome, the Eternal City, fell to Alaric the Goth. The moral accusations against the Christian majority by the shrinking pagan community then rose to a final crescendo. Augustine could little appreciate how beside the point the pagan criticisms would soon appear. He summons all his powers to write his final masterpiece, The City of God, in which human reality is divided in two. Babylon, the city of man, which necessarily ends in corruption and death, and the New Jerusalem, the city of God, which flourishes eternally beyond all strife. Rome, though better than most human political establishments, is doomed to perish, like all things in the corruptible sphere. Augustine's enemies are many. He crosses swords with Pelagius, an egregiously fat British monk who posits that God's grace is not always needed, that men, unassisted, can do good with the aid of their rational minds and their goodwill. Pelagius is a sort of Norman Vincent Peale, who thinks everyone who really wants to can pull himself up by his bootstraps. It is a case of Pelagius's "be all you can be" versus Augustine's "just as I am without one plea." Pelagius is also an elitist who believes that some men, the nice educated ones, are better than others. Augustine smells the Platonic fallacy, the equation of knowledge with virtue, and attacks mercilessly. He scores an easy win. He is surrounded, as are all the African Catholic bishops of his day, by Donatists, heretics who deny that the grace of the sacraments can be conferred through the offices of an unworthy priest, but in all other respects resemble their Catholic brethren. For Augustine, the sacraments of the Church are profoundly necessary. Without their aid, all men would, in their inevitable weakness, succumb to evil. Sacramental efficacy simply cannot hinge on the character of the administering priest. Augustine aligns himself with the civil arm to persecute the Donatists and bring them forcibly within the walls of Catholicism. He subsequently writes the first Catholic justification for state persecution of those in error. Error has no rights. To disbelieve in forced conversions is to deny the power of God, and God must whip the son he receives. Per molestios eruditio. True education begins with physical abuse. This from the man who condemned the punishments and cruel threats of his childhood classroom. Augustine, the last great man of Roman antiquity, is going over the edge. The doctrine he has enunciated will echo down the ages in the cruelest infamies. Executed with the highest justification. Augustine, father of many firsts, is also father of the Inquisition. In his old age, Augustine is challenged by Julian of Eclanum, a young, aristocratically educated married bishop, a species of Pelagian, who finds distasteful Augustine's theories of original sin, or at least some of their implications. Augustine, who, as we saw, believed that God had predestined each of us from all eternity, therefore finds it necessary to assume that God will condemn to hellfire all the unbaptized, even infants who die without the sacrament. Augustine justifies God's justice as inscrutable. Julian counters that Augustine